The Statue of Liberty. Paris has the Eiffel Tower, Rome has the Colosseum, and we've got the Statue of Liberty. To me, it's the icon of New York, and it moves me to see it up close, even to see photographs of it, and to think about what it symbolizes. I often imagine the boats of immigrants who have sailed into New York Harbor with that amazing statue to greet them. It still stands proudly today. Despite our sometimes strained political relations, we should not forget that this landmark was a gift from the country of France, the France of liberty, equality, and fraternity. The French recognized our quest as Americans and gave us this incredible symbol in appreciation for what America represents. I think that the recent divide between France and the United States is a tragedy. We would have felt as bad for them if the Eiffel Tower or La Défense had been destroyed as they felt for us when the towers came down on September 11th. For one of the opening scenes for the second season of The Apprentice, Mark Burnett and his crew took me to the Statue of Liberty. As we approached Lady Liberty, I was taken back to my youth when I was told I was fortunate to be in America, that I had opportunities that other people in the world could only dream about. And here I am, a major player in the greatest city of this incredible country, and I realize once again how amazingly lucky I have been. With the parents that I had and this country as my backbone, anything was possible. I operated on that premise of possibility, and I'm walking, talking proof of the American dream. For me, the American dream is not just a dream, it's a reality. Breakfast at the Waldorf. I like going to the Waldorf, especially when I'm receiving an award. Recently, the IRTS, the International Radio and Television Society, had a breakfast for me. The casts from Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Sex and the City, producer Michael Patrick King, Bob Schieffer of Face the Nation, and Herb Scandal of Nickelodeon Networks. Jeff Zucker of NBC was also there to announce that while it took five guys to save Bravo, it only took one, me, to save NBC. Then Bob Wright, chairman and CEO of NBC, took the stage to introduce me. It was an honor to receive the award because, as Bob Schieffer mentioned, we have a responsibility in the television and radio industry to try to make media intelligent. That's our approach with The Apprentice, and to be recognized for my contribution feels great. As our culture changes, so must our television, or it would lose relevance. In addition to providing entertainment, radio and television have increasingly become powerful tools for educational enlightenment. I keep this in mind for both my radio and my television programs. As power breakfasts go, that one was up there with the best. And we all agreed to keep up the good work. 10 amazing minutes. Steve Wynn recently called and told me he was about to bid on a great painting, a Vermeer. The auction was taking place at Sotheby's in London, and Steve asked me to listen in on the bidding process. It was very interesting, especially for someone like me who has never been a big buyer of paintings. Steve loves this Vermeer painting, and usually what Steve wants, he gets. The bidding began at $10 million and quickly escalated to $24 million when Steve entered the fray. People began to drop out, and finally it was just Steve and one other bidder until Steve ended up winning at $30 million. It was a really amazing 10 minutes, and Steve now has a painting by an artist whose work will probably never go to market again. I look forward to seeing it. People Magazine and What People Do. Ann Moore, the chairman and CEO of Time Incorporated, invited me to speak to a People Magazine management meeting to share a few secrets on your leadership success, as she put it. My speaking fee is typically $250,000, but because People Magazine has always treated me well, I decided to do Ann a favor. I opened the lunch meeting with the observation that they'd left me out of their latest issue, The 50 Most Beautiful People. But after setting that straight, we were off to a good time. I began by discussing the power of the media. When Jean Georges, the wonderful restaurant in the Trump International Hotel and Tower, first opened, I told Chef Jean-Georges von Gerichten that I absolutely hated the interior design and didn't even want to eat there because of it. He said, "Mr. Trump, I want people to notice the food, not the decor." I thought that was one of the greatest lines of pure bullshit I'd ever heard and told him so. Then the New York Times wrote an absolute rave review of the food, giving the restaurant its highest rating. And suddenly, I thought the room looked pretty good after all. The newspaper's analysis and praise of the restaurant completely changed my mind. That's power. I continue to alienate members of the press on occasion, but on the whole, I like them. I know their jobs aren't easy. That day, facing a room of attractive and attentive publishing types, I mentioned that while they may be lovely young women and sharp-looking young men, they couldn't fool me. I know they're vicious. I deal with vicious people every day. But most of the time, they look vicious. These people appeared well-polished, but I told them, "I know, they're out to get me." The room laughed. The media represents great power. As someone who has received a lot of attention from the media, I know that its power to make someone recognizable is unbelievable. I had always been relatively well-known, but it was nothing compared to my fame now. Even six-year-olds walk up to me in the street and shout, "You're fired!" And elderly men in their Rolls Royces in Palm Beach will roll down their windows to yell at me as they drive by. I thought I was famous before, but I was wrong. Now I'm famous. In order to comply with Anne's wish that this be a business meeting, I spent a few minutes talking about success and gave the audience some advice on how to find it for themselves. Then, as I suspected, I discovered that the only thing they were interested in was The Apprentice. I don't mind answering these questions, but the level of interest always surprises me. With this crowd, however, I also asked questions about the show. What did they like about it? Should I expand my inner circle of advisors? What task pertinent to magazine publishing would they come up with for the candidates, and so forth? One person asked me what had been the biggest surprise to me about the show. I answered that the biggest surprise had been the show's success. 95% of new TV shows don't make it. Those aren't odds I like, and it's a good thing I didn't know that going in, or I would never have signed on in the first place. As I was discussing The Apprentice, I also mentioned that prior to the show's success, I remembered standing with Melania behind a guy who was also waiting to get into the NBC Upfront event at Lincoln Center last year. I mentioned to Melania that he was a great-looking guy. It turned out to be Rob Lowe. He also had a new TV show coming up, and I remembered thinking that I really didn't want to go up against someone who looks like that. I'd never make it. Unfortunately, his show didn't make it, and mine made it big. So, you never know what will work. I also told the audience that I thought certain kinds of people shouldn't be on The Apprentice, such as Sam and Omarosa, who were loose cannons as far as I was concerned. But that's part of the entertainment factor. If we had had 16 intelligent, polished, and productive people from this room as candidates, it might not have been as interesting a mix. That's what Mark Burnett and his team do so well. They put together a group in which the common denominator may be intelligence and ambition, but with enough variety to be entertaining and maybe create some sparks along the way. Disasters can be more interesting than smooth sailing. So much for my casting instincts, but these are things we learn along the way. If it were up to me, I'd choose 16 supermodels. Not good. I ended the conversation by bringing the topic back to business. I mentioned that whomever I choose as a winner on The Apprentice will always be chosen from strictly a business, not an entertainment viewpoint. I don't want someone who is entertaining. I want someone who knows what they're doing. After all, my own life is entertaining enough. In praise of audacity, I agreed to give a speech in New York City to 700 people from Sanofi Centilabo Incorporated, a pharmaceutical company, for Patty Gil. Patty's a terrific businesswoman, and she and the Sanofi group had all been at my Mar-a-Lago club for a dinner a few months earlier, so I wanted to welcome them to my city. I know from experience that this group is hardworking. I had invited some of the team to play golf with me at the Trump International Golf Club in Palm Beach, and they all declined. Every single one of them turned me down. However, I realized that these people had their priorities straight. They love their work, are responsible for the positions they hold, and are completely focused. Over the course of my speech, I told them that if you can't dream about new products, they will never happen. I also pointed out how important it is to set their own standards. That will ensure that they remain innovators in their field. I already know how disciplined they are, so I'm stressing their creativity and urging them to go against the tide. In summing up, I told them what I've said before, but these are points worth repeating if you are intent on big success. Number one, think big. Number two, stay focused. Number three, be paranoid. Keep your guard up. Number four, be passionate. Number five, don't ever give up. Number six, love what you are doing. To be a winner, you must think like a winner. Try it. You'll be surprised. And before long, you might be thinking like a billionaire. Pageants. As the saying goes, Miss America is a girl who lives next door. Miss USA is a girl you wished lived next door. To diversify my investments, I entered into a partnership for ownership and broadcast rights with the NBC network for the three largest beauty competitions in the world, the Miss Universe, Miss USA, and Miss Teen USA pageants. Few people are aware of the large audience pageants have worldwide or the weight they carry internationally. Their value to the economies of the countries that host them is enormous, and the bidding for them is a competitive and serious business. While millions around the world tune in each year to see a new title holder crowned, few people realize just what the year entails for each young woman. All three, Miss USA, Miss Universe, and Miss Teen USA, become bona fide full-time employees of the Miss Universe organization and immediately put their lives on hold for a year to relocate to New York. They all move into a three-bedroom luxury suite in my Trump Place development. Whether or not you enjoy beauty pageants, they serve a good purpose aside from the celebration of beautiful young women. The importance of good works is at the center of the pageantry, and these women are using their gifts in incredible ways. In that sense, the pageants provide an excellent lesson for everyone. Marco de la Cruz, who works as a motivational coach in Los Angeles, told me how impressed he was with the contestants of the Miss USA pageant after working with them for a few weeks. He said that what might be perceived as a sexist or narcissistic event was much more than that, due to the social conscience the contestants displayed. He felt the pageant was a form of empowerment for women. I agree. What they will all be able to accomplish after this pageant is staggering. The pageant already aids the Make-A-Wish Foundation, breast cancer research, and AIDS research, and each contestant devotes a serious amount of time to a specific cause. Marco also noted the steady progression of confidence developing in each young woman as the weeks progressed. All in all, a good score. The ratings for the Miss USA pageant this year were the highest they have been in 10 years. The event took place in the glamorous and beautiful city of Los Angeles, and the contestants visited Universal Studios, Santa Monica Pier, the Queen Mary, and Hollywood. The show itself was held at the Kodak Theater, home of the Academy Awards, and was covered by Billy Bush and Nancy O'Dell for Access Hollywood. The after party and the lines to get in reminded me of Studio 54 in its heyday. After Miss USA is crowned and the credits have rolled, she flies immediately to her new Riverview Trump residence in New York, where she will spend her reign pursuing professional goals and making appearances on behalf of our charitable partners. No other pageant system in the world is set up this way. Every other beauty queen stays home until she's called to make an appearance. When not traveling around the world, our title holders spend every week volunteering during the day and attending A-list events at night. As Miss USA 2004, Shandy Finnessy is an official spokesperson for breast and ovarian cancer awareness. She will assist in raising millions of dollars on behalf of these organizations. The benchmark is enormously high. As Miss USA 2003, 24-year-old Susie Castillo helped raise $28 million for the same cause. Shandy happens to be a gorgeous blonde who is working toward her doctorate degree in counseling, and she is an advocate for mentally challenged children. Shandy has traveled to Korea to entertain troops with the USO and will travel later in the year to the Middle East. When a woman becomes Miss Universe, her world is turned upside down. When Jennifer Hawkins, Miss Universe 2004, left her home in Australia for the pageant in Quito, Ecuador, she was able to be in Sydney without being recognized. Now, having been featured on the cover of every magazine and newspaper down under, and having been the subject of several television shows, she has become an instant celebrity. In her new role as spokesperson for HIV and AIDS awareness, Jennifer has been a moderator at the International AIDS Conference in Bangkok, and she will spend the year meeting with world leaders focused on this terrible pandemic. She is also one of the most beautiful women I have ever seen. Tammy Farrell, 19-year-old Miss Teen USA 2004, hails from a farm in Phoenix, Oregon. She has spent the year as an advocate for DARE and other teen-related causes. Prior to the pageant, she had never left Oregon. Now she has traveled all over the United States in addition to a first-class trip to London and Berlin. When they are not globetrotting, these three beauties are roommates, which can sometimes be more traumatic than the apprentice apartment. Bill Rancic never had to worry about a misplaced $100,000 tiara. The Mar-a-Lago diet. You can't just think like a billionaire. You have to eat like one, too. Whether you have a world-class chef preparing all your meals or just a simple hot plate, always remember, you are what you eat. Gary Gregson, the executive chef of the Mar-a-Lago Club and the Trump International Golf Course, has worked for me for 9 years, and he's one of the top chefs in the world. His job is to make sure that all of our guests eat well during their stay. The guests include national and local politicians, television personalities, movie stars, musicians, and the wealthiest of the wealthy. Gary's job is demanding, but he's an absolute pro. Gary used to keep a list of all the notables that have been entertained at the Mar-a-Lago Club, but the list just got too long. There are just too many people who want to experience Mar-a-Lago. What keeps them coming back? Gary tells me that it's his food. And I'm inclined to believe him. You may not believe me, but I keep to a somewhat strict diet, a diet that Gary invented for me. We call it the Mar-a-Lago diet, and if I didn't adhere to it from time to time, my waistline would be an absolute disaster. I'll admit that I go for the occasional DT burger or ice cream or pizza, but for the most part, I watch what I eat. How do you go about getting started on the Mar-a-Lago diet? Visiting the Mar-a-Lago Club is a good start, but you can also try it at home. Gary developed the Mar-a-Lago diet with me in mind. He tells me that it has a lot in common with some other popular diets out there right now, but the Mar-a-Lago diet is more sustainable and far more realistic than the others. And it works. A former Miss Universe who had gained some weight stayed at Mar-a-Lago, and after a couple of weeks, she was back in pageant shape. Gary believes that it's ridiculous to think that you can enjoy life without carbohydrates and sugar. Everyone's avoiding bread, pasta, rice, and potatoes these days. Next month, people will probably be swearing off fruits and vegetables. You have to satisfy your appetite and stay balanced. It's as simple as that. The Mar-a-Lago diet is not what you can't eat, but what you can and should eat to stay thin. Part of the Mar-a-Lago diet is always fulfilling your cravings as they develop, as ridiculous as those cravings may be. Gary's motto may as well be, "Want caviar on your Dover sole? No worries. What about caviar on your scrambled eggs? Even better." Breakfast might consist of an egg white omelet with spinach, tomatoes, and a little feta cheese, a small cup of tropical fruit, and a mimosa made with freshly squeezed orange juice. Lunch could be a small portion of tilapia and steamed vegetables with fresh herbs and extra virgin olive oil, served with yogurt sauce on the side, iced tea with lemon, and fresh blueberries for dessert. Dinner depends on whom you're dining with. If you're eating alone or with your spouse, you can cut back a bit. When you're dining with guests and friends, you should indulge a bit more. One of my favorite meals at Mar-a-Lago is lemongrass-infused salmon with scallion pancakes. I also enjoy the yellow heirloom tomato gazpacho with summer squash and lingonberry sorbet, which is out of this world. I tend to be a little more partial to meals that include Caesar salad, meatloaf, strip steak, or roast chicken, and you should adjust your diet based upon your own tastes. With immediate family and close friends, there tend to be larger portions and multiple courses. Pan-seared foie gras with spiced pumpkin bread and wild Maine blueberries, followed by mango soup with shallot flan, is one of Gary's classics. He also serves Parmesan-crusted sea bass with celeriac potatoes, bok choy, and sauce beurre blanc. To finish the meal, even if you're on the Mar-a-Lago diet, Gary often provides a selection of minuscule desserts or an incredible Grand Marnier souffle. If you're a drinker, which I'm not, enjoy a glass of fine wine, but don't overindulge in alcohol. It can be a high-calorie and dangerous habit. I once asked Gary to tally up the food orders during the busiest part of Mar-a-Lago season. Apparently, it's not unusual for the club to purchase 100 pounds of Florida stone crab, 40 pounds of fresh grade A foie gras, 12 points of high-grade caviar, Ocetra beluga or Sevruga, and 400 pounds of sea bass each week. And of course, all these foods work within the Mar-a-Lago diet. To summarize the Mar-a-Lago diet, number one, it has to be served in a fantastic setting. Number two, it has to look fantastic. Number three, it has to taste incredible. Number four, it cannot make you gain weight. If you eat the best foods and watch your waistline, you'll begin to look and feel great in no time. Saturday Night Live. One day in late March of 2004, Jeff Zucker, the brilliant president of NBC, called to make an appointment to see me at my office. I knew something big must be up for him to pay a personal visit. He said, "I'd like to see you." So he arrived in my office and said, "Donald, do me a favor. Host Saturday Night Live." I like and respect Jeff a great deal, and we'd been experiencing a tremendous success with The Apprentice, so I couldn't say no. I'd like to say that I showed up a few hours before the show on Saturday, April 3rd, tried on some costumes, learned a few lines, and then did the show live with the help of the hilarious Saturday Night Live regulars. As with The Apprentice, that wasn't the case. It took up a few days of my time. A few days well worth it, as experiences go. Saturday Night Live is a legendary show, and being asked to be the host was a great honor. Considering its 29-year history, I was walking into something big. And something new to me. Comedy skits, a monologue, a face-to-face with someone who imitates me for a living. A chicken number. Were they joking? Yes, and quite well. Here's how the show came together that week. Preparation. On Tuesday, I met with Lorne Michaels' terrific team of 17 writers, led by Tina Fey. They pitched ideas and asked questions. We chatted for about 1 hour. How much could they get in 1 hour? Plenty, as it turned out. On Wednesday, the writers had 35 sketches completed, which they presented to me in a series of read-throughs. Some of these writers had been at SNL for over a decade. Five are new this year, and one was new that week. The job of an SNL writer is tough. There's no fooling around. Lorne Michaels and Marcy Klein certainly know what they're doing. After the 35 sketches were finished, they narrowed them down to approximately 12 skits considered viable for the show. This process took about 3 hours, and then I was free to go back to my office. On Thursday, we read through the chosen sketches where I interacted with members of the SNL team and got a feel for the format of the show. On Friday, we had our first full day, which started at 1:30 p.m. and ended at 10:30 p.m. We blocked and did run-throughs of the skits on undressed sets on the SNL stage. Originally Toscanini's recording studio and built on springs to avoid the rumble of the subways underneath the NBC building. That space is historic. It has about 7,000 square feet of workable space, which isn't a lot, considering what the show accomplishes every week. In the first skit, I played a hippie in a business meeting about the worldwide marketing of bongs. After three quick run-throughs, I realized that I was dreading having to wear the long blonde wig they'd picked out for me. Luckily, this skit would be cut during dress rehearsal. I hate messing up my hair for any reason, even for SNL. On the way to the next skit, I stopped and chatted with Greg Tull, who had worked at SNL as head of props for 25 years. He's also a fellow graduate of the New York Military Academy. He reassured me when he told me I was doing a great job so far, a vote of confidence I trusted, as he's watched countless rehearsals over the years. The second skit involved my so-called latest romance novel, Erotic Moonlight Confessions. The protagonist, Ronald Strump, lives in a famous skyscraper in the penthouse apartment with citywide views. Convinced it will be a bestseller, I happen to be the narrator. As it turned out, this favored sketch of mine, short and easy, would also be cut after dress rehearsal. We took a short break, so I returned to my dressing room, passing the pretzel and potato chip bins, and made a few phone calls and checked in with the office. The very talented Jim Dowd of NBC showed up to give me a tour of the control room. I got to know Jim while working on The Apprentice. He doesn't stop. Saturday Night Live is a big operation, and everyone involved is a pro. Back on the set, Stone Phillips of Dateline stopped by to visit. He had been down at my Mar-a-Lago club in Florida over the past weekend doing a story. Then Lorne Michaels came in to say hello. The set was buzzing with activity, and through the windows above the audience bleachers, we could see the NBC tour participants watching us. They waved and gave me the "you're fired" gesture. Just what I needed, some votes of confidence. Fortunately, they hadn't seen enough yet to pass judgment, so I waved back. Then I had some rehearsals, one with Finesse Mitchell, for a lawyer-client skit that included the Harlem Globetrotters, and another with Daryl Hammond, the brilliant impersonator who can nail just about everyone from Bill Clinton to Regis Philbin to me. The skit was titled The Prince and the Pauper, and it required a costume change mid-scene that the writers were still trying to nail down. By then it was 6 p.m. and we were on a dinner break. Jeff Richmond came in with a keyboard to go over some lyrics with me for the boardroom band scene, and it only took about 5 minutes. Andrew, an accommodating page at SNL, brought in a steak for me from the Palm. It arrived with plastic utensils. I made a stab at it, but Andrew ran up to Lorne Michaels' office to find some silver for me. I found some golf to watch on TV and relaxed for a while. A bit later, I signed a dollar bill for the Friday raffle, an SNL tradition. This raffle is a big event announced by drumrolls on the set, and the crew tried to pull one over on me by announcing my name as a winner. However, I already knew the buzz around there. It turned out that Lonnie in wardrobe was the winner. So it was back to the set for the boardroom band scene, the most complicated scene for me, as I had to play the keyboard, sing, and remember some complex lines and lyrics. Where was Billy Joel when I needed him? We did the Chicken Wings number involving Trump's House of Wings, which seemed to be popular right from the start. I kept thinking, how do I get myself into these things? I had nixed the chicken outfit, but I did see a strange-looking yellow suit around the set, which had me worried. We took a break, and Lorne visited me for a while. Carolyn Kepcher arrived to run through her scene. She was relieved to know her lines were limited. Scripts aren't her thing, either. I went back out to practice the opening monologue. The monologue had to be the most difficult part of the show. I would come out on stage, address millions of people, and hope to be funny. I asked the set builders, how did I ever get into this? I should be building like you. I can relate to you guys. We practiced the monologue a couple of times with Daryl as my understudy and with Jimmy Fallon playing Jeff Zucker. We got some good laughs, and then we called it a night. It was already 11 p.m. by then. The live show. We had a 1 p.m. call, and I was there on time. Saturday would be another rehearsal on dress sets and a semi-dress rehearsal. We made changes as we went along, so I had to pay close attention all day long. Not surprisingly, that pastel yellow suit showed up in my dressing room. I tried it on and asked myself a few questions, specifically, what the hell am I doing here? Chris Kelly, the stage manager, offered me the neon chicken wings sign for my office in Trump Tower as a souvenir. My memories would be vivid enough, but it was thoughtful of him. We ran through the show, which included three encounters with Star Jones of the TV show The View. Star was played by Kenan Thompson. I also visited the set of Live with Regis and Kelly, as played by Daryl Hammond and Amy Poehler. I liked all the skits, but realized that only certain ones would make the live show. The Saturday Night Live setup is theatrical in concept. If the show works for a live audience of 300 people, it will work for national TV. The dress rehearsal audience is the focus group for the live show. The skits with the best audience response remain in the live show. The others are cut. The dress rehearsal ran from 8 to 10 p.m., and the live show began at 11:30 p.m. Not until after the dress rehearsal would we know the content or the running order of the live show. We had a dinner break, and I decided to visit the NBC canteen. What a great setup, with all kinds of entrees and salads and 7 or 8 desserts and puddings. I had some great chicken and mashed potatoes that I took back to my dressing room. Matthew Calamari came to visit and ended up joining me for dinner. George Ross and Carolyn Kepcher also arrived for dress rehearsal, so they visited for a while, too. Steve Higgins of the Saturday Night Live team came in to go over some writing issues as skits were still being fine-tuned. I heard the guest band Toots and the Maytals practicing out on the set. They sounded terrific, and I went out to listen to them for a while. My daughter Ivanka had told me how great they are, and she was right. The music relaxed me, and surprisingly, I was not at all nervous. At that point, the fantastic Sharon Sinclair, a makeup artist, took me to get ready for the dress rehearsal, and by 8 p.m., the show had begun before a live audience. I had a few friends and colleagues there, so I knew that I could count on a few free laughs. One half hour of the show would be cut, and I was curious to see what would go and what would stay. Unfortunately, some of my favorite skits were cut. The Finesse Mitchell tour de force, the audio version of my new romance novel, and a couple of close encounters with Star Jones. But all in all, it would still be a great show. Melania, Don Jr., Ivanka, Eric, John Myers, John Mack, and some of my best friends had arrived, and their presence was a big comfort, considering what I was about to do. Then the music started up, and it was showtime. Live, this time, in front of the world. The live show was an hour and a half long, a total whirlwind. We had small portable dressing areas set up on the set for fast changes, and an experienced team of dressers, led by Donna Richards, made sure I was ready for each scene. Did I ever think I'd be the star of a hit television series? No. Did I ever think I'd be the host of SNL? Not in a million years. After the show, I signed some photos for the crew, including one that will hang in the hallowed halls of Saturday Night Live for all time. It was a night to remember. Both Lorne Michaels and Jeff Zucker seemed pleased with the show, and I thanked them for a wonderful experience. We all left for the after-show party. For the record, and this may be a record, I got home at 6 a.m. on Sunday, just in time to get up and read my newspapers and start a new day. And to top it all, the ratings turned out to be great. A week in the life. It's become a tradition for me to include a chapter in my books about a typical week in my life. Readers always tell me they like these sections the best, and I don't want to disappoint anyone. Here's a snapshot of this spring before the second season of The Apprentice took over my life. There are some good examples buried within about how I think about my time, my business, and the people that surround me. Monday, 8:30 a.m. I have a meeting with Matthew Calamari, Executive Vice President, and Norma Forderer, Vice President, about Trump Ice, my new bottled water, and about the You're Fired t-shirts, which we can't keep in stock due to a high demand. As problems go, it's a nice problem to have. After seeing the popularity of bottled water, I decided to join the competition with my own. It's certainly an interesting market. During our meeting, Steve Riggio of Barnes & Noble calls in, so I talked to him for a while. He had ordered a huge number of my last book, How to Get Rich, and called to say he was glad he did. Steve and Len, his brother, have done a great job with Barnes & Noble. 9 a.m. I do a short video in the conference room for Rich Handler's son, Max. It's for a school project. Afterward, he comes into my office and we give him a tour. I hope he gets a good report card. He will be a winner. 9:15 a.m. We have a Trump Tower board meeting in the large conference room. Larry Twill is present, as is Sonia Telesnik from my staff, among others. These meetings are important to me, and I never neglect them. That's lesson number one in property management. We cover a lot of territory at these meetings, the operations of the buildings, personnel, security, maintenance, construction, as well as the ongoing sales and leasing status of the units. Eric Sacher of my accounting department prepares a financial status report of the building, and we discuss improvements and upgrades, such as the renovations of hallways and anything that will provide our tenants with the best surroundings. 10 a.m. I call Paul Spengler of Pebble Beach to talk about stone walls. Paul's a great guy and full of good advice. 10:15 a.m. Rona comes in to tell me that Chris Matthews is ready for our scheduled interview. We're both on time and it's done quickly and efficiently. Chris is the kind of guy I like playing hardball with. 10:45 a.m. We all watch Don Jr. on CNN Finance. He mentions how he's the original apprentice and how his interest in our business and working with me have been a natural progression for him. He comes across as focused and intelligent, which he is, and mentions how much he's enjoyed overseeing the redevelopment of Trump Park Avenue. He's done a great job, I might add. This building is a former Delmonico Hotel, a famed hotel that once hosted Ed Sullivan and the Beatles. It's not only beautiful, but historic as well. 11 a.m. I make and take calls from Scott Butera, John Tutelo of Trump Model Management, and Ashley Cooper of Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey. They have positive updates for me, so it's smooth sailing so far. I also take calls from Tony Veneziano, Ray Royce, Jay Neveloff, and Phil Ruffin. These guys all get to the point quickly. It's a pleasure doing business with them. 11:45 a.m. My development team comes in for a meeting, which includes Charlie Reese, Don Jr., Russell Flicker, and Jill Kremer. We spend a few moments congratulating Russell on the birth of his daughter, Molly, over the weekend. Being a father is a great honor, and I'm happy for him. My team is on target on their projects, and Canoan Island is going to be a piece of paradise in no time. Canoan is off the island of Moustique, and it will be the new definition of the word elite. Canoan Island was brought to my attention by this team, and it will not only rival Bali in beauty and amenities, but it will be much more accessible. We will have an 18-hole championship golf course designed by Jim Fazio and Trump Island Villas, which will consist of luxury villas and estate property set on 1,000 acres of lush, mountainous terrain overlooking the ocean. It will also have a European-style casino, Trump Club Privé. This island will be my first venture in the Caribbean, and we are all excited about it. 12:30 p.m. I take a call from Paula Shugart about the upcoming Miss Universe pageant in Quito, Ecuador. This event will be big, and we're going over all the details. The Miss USA pageant broke records this year, and we expect the Miss Universe contest to do even better. People couldn't believe I actually went into the beauty pageant business to make money. But it turns out I did, and we've had great success with them. Beautiful women can be a great attraction. I asked Rona to order some pizza for lunch, and I called Regis Philbin to chat. I also spent some time reviewing some reports on my properties. Since the final episode of the first season of The Apprentice, I've actually had time to devote myself fully to my properties. I like being a TV star, but I'm a builder at heart and always will be. I told Katie Couric on a recent appearance on the Today Show that she wouldn't have to see me again for a few months after I nearly became a regular on the morning lineup. I began calling the Today Show the Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow show to my staff. 1 p.m. I call Mike Vandergoes, director of Trump National Golf Course in Los Angeles, for an update. This course is becoming an unbelievable beauty, thanks to Pete Dye's expertise and Mike's daily care. I visited recently on a trip to Los Angeles and can't wait to play when the course opens. A friend calls in who had recently visited Paris and went to the Lido. In the show, an airplane arrives as a special effect, and the French people seated at the next table exclaimed, "Regardez, Donald Trump est arrivé," and then proceeded to discuss The Apprentice. Apparently, they received tapes of the episodes from American friends. Guess I'm world famous. I get a call about the Apprentice sign that had hung in front of Trump Tower until the final episode. It's no longer there, but it caused some media attention, as the city almost fined me for it. The amount of money and tourism the Apprentice has generated for the city of New York doesn't seem to matter to city officials. Should I be surprised? I call Melania to see what time I need to be ready tonight. We're going to the costume ball at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is a fabulous event in New York City, especially since I don't have to wear a costume. This reminds me of something, and I call Anna Wintour at Vogue magazine. She is fantastic. 1:30 p.m. I call Carolyn Kepcher for an update on activities at Trump National Golf Club at Briarcliff Manor. It should be a great season. Even with all her apprentice-related duties, she's remained as effective and efficient as ever as an executive vice president. She could be categorized as a Wonder Woman, considering her executive activities, being a regular on a hit TV series, and being the mother of two children. She handles it all. I take a call from Paul Davis, CEO at Trump Place. He's another gem. He's got an enormous property to watch over, and with his amazing talent, I can be assured it's in good hands. This property is not only a property to me, but a community. Visit the pier sometime at twilight, and you will have yourself a New York experience to remember. I go over the lyric sheets for the Katie Couric benefit aboard the Queen Mary 2 coming up in New York City. I'll be accompanied by Harry Connick Jr. Since I've already done some singing on Saturday Night Live, this event shouldn't be too hard. It should be a great night. I hope Harry can keep up with me. However, according to this script, he fires me. Life, as we all know, isn't fair. Jay Beanstock and Kevin Harris of Mark Burnett Productions are back in town. They come in to review assignments for the second season of The Apprentice. I can't discuss these with you now, but it looks like we're in for another exciting series. I have a comfortable rapport with all of Mark's people, and it's a productive meeting. We'll be shooting an intro scene at the Statue of Liberty next week, provided we can get clearance in these days of heightened security. 2:30 p.m. I returned several calls that came in during the meeting. We are still debating which ballroom chair design we will use in Palos Verdes, home of Trump National Golf Club, Los Angeles, and several chairs have been brought in and lined up in my office to view and think about. There's a spectacular ballroom at the clubhouse for formal events. I'll keep the chairs in my office for a few days to see how they sit with me. The wrong chairs will ruin the entire room. In fact, I'd better see a few more, and I ask that a total of 8 styles be brought in. This ballroom has apparently become the number one choice for weddings, and it is booked far, far in advance. Norma keeps my calendar straight, which has become an even greater challenge these days than ever before. She comes in to update me about the week's important events, board meetings, and so forth. She also tells me of humorous calls. This morning, we had an Al Pacino impersonator call to talk to me, a call which almost got to my office until Al asked one of my assistants for her phone number. And we received another check for $250,000 from someone who will pay to work here, a phenomenon that has occurred several times in the past few months. If we thought we received a lot of mail and calls before The Apprentice, we were right. We did. But we now have 10 times that amount, and we are doing our best to keep up with it. However, if it takes a longer time to hear back from us, you'll know why. 3 p.m. Jason Greenblatt comes in to go over a few things, and Bernie Diamond, general counsel, comes in to discuss licensing issues. My legal team is kept extremely busy, and they are conscientious about keeping me informed. Even George Ross, with his commitment of time to The Apprentice, has managed to keep up with all the new developments we've encountered as we deal with territory more familiar to a production company than a property management organization. I think we've all enjoyed the new challenges, and no one here can ever complain of boredom. Dan Roth of Fortune magazine calls in to discuss the positive buzz his cover article about me has generated. The article is titled, "The Trophy Life." You think Donald Trump's hit reality show is a circus? Spend a few weeks watching him work. People are always surprised at how hard I work, which I have to say surprises me, because I don't consider it work, but rather fun. 3:30 p.m. Jeff Zucker of NBC calls, and we discuss the incredible ratings the final episode of The Apprentice generated. Close to 41 million viewers watched. These were stunning numbers for a new show or an old show, and I'm proud of it. If I'm going to do something, no matter what it is, I want it to be great. There have been nearly 1 million applications received for the second season of The Apprentice, which is close to 5 times more than for the first season. NBC and I are looking forward to the new season. A reporter calls in to verify that I offered to pay for Troy's education on Larry King Live. Troy was on The Apprentice and has a lot of smarts, but not much education. He's a good example of someone who deserves the best, which includes great schooling. Guys like Troy make America great. 3:45 p.m. The next call is a good one. This contractor is so full of it that I hang up on him. Until he comes to his senses, which I think will take at least a few days considering what I've just heard, I won't be taking his calls. Instead, I call Ron Barron for some levity. 4 p.m. My pilot, Mike Donovan, calls in. The most important thing to consider when you have your own 727 is the right pilot to go with it. And I have been very lucky to have Mike. What is it about Mondays? Here's another contractor who is totally out of his mind. If today were April Fool's Day, I could manage these idiot calls, but it isn't. And this next call gets a well-deserved slam into the receiver. Costas Candelas, a man with brains and elegance, calls, which is a relief from the last few phone calls. We go over some details and discuss the impending Olympics in Athens. Costas is from Greece and has great insights into Greek culture. One reason I like to read Greek philosophers, as I mentioned in my last book, is because of Costas's influence. I call Tiffany in California. I saw her recently when I attended the Miss USA pageant at the Kodak Theater in Hollywood. Rick and Kathy Hilton also attended with us, as did Roberto Del Hoyo of the Beverly Hills Hotel. 4 p.m. John Spitalny of Bear Stearns calls. We play golf together and enjoy discussing a lot of different things. John gives finance another dimension entirely when he starts in on something. He's an example of someone who applies comprehensive knowledge to specific scenarios. He's an expert of the highest level. He keeps an open mind to everything, and if you ask him a question, he'll find a way to answer you on the level you can relate to most readily. I call John Stark, another great guy, and take a call from Joe Cinque of the 5-Star Diamond Hospitality Awards. We discuss one of our favorite places, the Beverly Hills Hotel, and what makes it so special, which is basically everything. It's a full and total class act. Joe is adamant about his praise for my Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach, which is fine with me. We discuss the new ballroom at Mar-a-Lago, which is close to being finished. We also discuss the fact that our receptionist at the Trump Organization, Georgette Malone, has returned today after recovering from a vicious attack by a pit bull. Doctors were able to save her fingers and hands, but it's been a long process. We are all happy to have her back in almost one piece. Allow me a few words of advice. Don't keep pit bulls for pets. After seeing what happened to Georgette, I will never forget it, and neither will any of us here. I take a few calls regarding different properties and then talk to Elaine Dirots about events at the Trump World Tower. Since people saw the penthouse on an episode of The Apprentice, this building has become a hot property. There's a huge waiting list of people wanting to buy. Tom Downing, general manager of Trump International Hotel and Tower, calls in. Tom was also featured on The Apprentice in the semi-final round of interviews, and he's an important member of our organization. We'll be filming a task assignment for the upcoming season of The Apprentice at Jean Georges, the restaurant that is located in the hotel. Running a great hotel is demanding, but under Tom's leadership, the hotel has been consistently lauded by critics and guests. 4:30 p.m. Alan Weisselberg, my CFO, comes in for a meeting, and then I show him some carpet swatches and ask his opinion. I like to get as many opinions as I can before making a decision. I also ask him about the chairs I'm considering. Rona comes in, and I ask her opinion as well. These chairs aren't quite right, and I realize that I'll have to ask to see some more. 5 p.m. I review some photographs of developments and read a pile of faxes that have come in. We have several fax machines, and they never stop. Then I review a stack of letters. I like to read the ones from students. Some schools have written about each episode of The Apprentice and what they have learned from it. In one class in Illinois, Troy is the most popular candidate, followed by Kwame, and they think New York City looks like a lot of fun. They have sent in 28 handwritten reviews, and while I may not agree with everything they say, I will say I admire their penmanship. I cannot respond to all of them except to thank them for their time and thoughtful comments. 5:30 p.m. I sign a book for Alex Rodriguez, better known as A-Rod, when he comes to our offices for a visit. I take him around and enjoy seeing the surprised expressions on everyone's faces. We peek into a meeting in the large conference room, and everyone does a double take. He's hard to miss, and it's a great way to end a Monday. I had met A-Rod before, as he is looking at an apartment in Trump Park Avenue. He's a great guy, and a great player. 6 p.m. Robin tells me one of the crazy contractors I spoke to earlier has called back again. They can all forget about it today. Enough is enough. I take some faxes and documents and head upstairs. Tuesday, 8:45 a.m. I have a meeting with Steve Cantor of Credit Suisse First Boston and Brian Harris, Peter Smith, and Matthew Kirsch of UBS. I like these guys, and our meetings are never a problem. I've always gotten along with bankers, and I appreciate their perspective. People sometimes ask me about the best way to deal with bankers. I always tell them to give them the respect they deserve. That's the best way. 9:30 a.m. I have a Diet Coke and read an article wherein I am called the Elvis of business. I'll take it as a compliment. Rona comes in to give me my messages, and I ask her to return some calls. I look over some photos from the final episode of The Apprentice and from the party we had at Trump Tower afterward. It was a media circus, but we all had fun. I never thought it would take 1 hour to walk 100 feet, but it did. My beautiful sister Marianne attended, but could take only about 15 minutes of it before slipping out. Here's a great photo of her with Norma. I asked Rona to send it to her. 10 a.m. We watch Mike Vandergoes, director of Trump National Golf Course Los Angeles, being interviewed on Fox TV about his job being offered as one of two choices for the Apprentice finalist. Mike had been advised of this possibility, and I have to say I was relieved when Bill Rancic chose the Chicago Tower as his project, since Mike is doing such a great job. He also gave a terrific live interview. Fortunately, Mike has many qualifications, including being an accomplished golfer, so we would have been able to find a suitable position for him within our organization without any problem. Versatility is always a benefit for everyone, but we're glad Mike is where he is. Helmut Schroeder, who manages some properties for me in New Jersey, comes in for a visit, so we chat for a while, and Robin comes in to advise me that Paula Shugart and our new Miss USA, Shandy Finnessy, of Missouri, are here to see me. I'd picked Shandy as my first choice during the pageant in Los Angeles, and I was right. She's a beauty. Tom Barrick calls in. Tom is one of the smartest real estate investors in the United States. He is looking to invest in my 90-story building in Chicago. He heads the Colony Capital Fund, and I built a building at 610 Park Avenue with Tom. It's been a terrific success. Not only is Tom a brilliant investor, he is also a great friend. 10:30 a.m. Our mysterious Al Pacino impersonator calls in again. Whoever he is, he's pretty good, but not good enough. We finally get rid of him. I really doubt that Al Pacino is anxious to apply as a candidate for The Apprentice. We call Al's office and let them know someone is impersonating him. 11 a.m. Norma comes in to advise me of the service for Estee Lauder, who recently passed on. She is one of the most remarkable people I've ever known, and I'm sorry she's gone. She left a beautiful heritage for us, and she will never be forgotten. Her little business, as she referred to the cosmetics line she founded, controls 45% of the cosmetics market in U.S. department stores. She had an idea and just went with it. She was one of the great salespeople of all time and a great example for all business people.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.